The enforcer is standing by for your calls, and if you'd like to ring us up, she will vet you and probably let you talk to me if you're nice to her. I have noticed something happening in the last 4 years. I've mentioned it in the past, and there's another example of it that has come up recently in Time magazine, and I want you to be aware of it if you're not already. It was mid-October 2001, or maybe early November, but I remember the smoke was still rising from the destroyed Twin Towers building there in New York City when Thomas Friedman wrote a very important piece in the New York Times entitled The Real War. Thomas Friedman is part of the cognoscenti of this country, arguably one of the experts, one of the best experts on Middle East and the politics of that region. But here he offered reflections of what I would consider a different sort, and that was that the real war, which is what he was writing about, wasn't really against Muslim terrorists, that terrorism was just a tool in a larger war in which the bad guys were those that he described as religious totalitarians. And religious totalitarians, it turns out, on further reading, are those people who actually believe their religion is true. And he said, these are the real enemy. And the only answer is moderation in religious claims. And what this means essentially is skepticism or agnosticism or a kind of politically correct tolerance, which says, I'm right for me, you're right for you, let's all try to get along. Now, of course, I don't know why we can't get along in the future like we've done for the last 200 years with people saying, yes, I'm right and I think you're wrong, but I'll respect you even though I don't care for your ideas. I mean, that seems to have worked fine, but now the equation has changed. Well, I was surprised to see that then. I noted it at the time. I've made reference to it a number of times since then. But I have noticed something else in the last 4 or 5 years now, that this theme has been repeated a number of times and is gaining momentum. And so what has happened as a result of the bombings in 2001, September 11th, was that in the last 5 years, Islam, though those bombings were perpetrated by Muslim terrorists, Islam has received most favored religious status in this country. That is, among the politically correct, you just don't criticize Islam. Now, you can criticize terrorists, but they have hijacked Islam. That isn't the real Islam. The real Islam is a more moderate sort. Now, I think that's false, but that's not my point. My point is that you can't speak against Islam. But you can speak against Christianity, and the language against Christianity has gotten much more aggressive, such that Christianity is the problem, and there is now a moral parity being constructed between the Islamofascists, the terrorists who have hijacked Islam, according to the views of some, that dangerous set, and another equally dangerous set, and that would be people like you and I suspect, if you're a regular listener to the show, that people who are followers of Jesus Christ who think that Jesus of Nazareth got it right. And therefore, that dictates a certain way of life and a way of talking and a way of engaging ideas in our modern culture. We're the bad guys. Now, don't misread me here. I am not whining and crying. I'm not saying poor me. I'm just acknowledging the fact of the matter. And part of the application here for you, if you're a follower of Jesus of Nazareth, is that you stay the course and understand the clouds are growing on the horizon and you don't get scared away. You don't get intimidated into altering your message. But I mentioned that this message has been increasing. Their message that we are dangerous is coming on stronger and stronger. In fact, in the last 4 weeks, I have gotten reports from cultural icons with regards to cultural icons like Bill Maher, who I saw on the No Spin Zone the other night, last week, And I heard Rosie O'Donnell, another cultural icon, and most recently Time Magazine's Andrew Sullivan. Actually, I don't know that he works for Time Magazine, but he has a piece published in the October 9th issue of this year. When not seeing is believing is the title of this. And this is just the latest rendition of the same theme. But since I've heard three principals speak of this in the last 3 weeks, it is an alert not just to me but also to you that the this way of looking at our cultural problems is finding public favor with more and more people who are willing to talk about it aggressively. Now, Andrew Sullivan's piece, When Not Seeing is Believing, is about the phenomenon of people, the danger of those who have religious certainty. And I think the article is worth reading. You might be able to go to Time's website and download it, or just Google the title, When Not Seeing is Believing, and I'm sure Sullivan has it printed somewhere where you can download it. It's a great exercise for critical thinking because, first of all, it's very well written. Sullivan's a good writer. You might recognize the name. Andrew Sullivan is one of the most articulate homosexual activists in the country, promoters of same-sex marriage and the like. But here he's not speaking so much about that. He's making an observation about the cultural scene and the concerns that he has about the direction it's going, particularly the dangerous direction that it is being pushed by people of religious conviction who are not agnostic, who are not skeptics, who are not especially doubtful, but who have, as he puts it, certainty that God is on their side. And this, of course, is the point of view of the terrorists who are blowing things up and have been doing so for a number of years now. Therefore, this makes all such fundamentalists dangerous. Now, there is a fundamental mistake that's being made here. And I've said this before. In fact, it was my response when Thomas Friedman wrote his piece 5 years ago. And that is that it isn't that you think your religion is true or your doctrines are true that is the problem. It's what doctrines or religion you think to be true is the problem. For goodness sakes, Mother Teresa was certain about her religious convictions, but nobody ever mentions her, except for O'Reilly the other night, opposite Bill Maher. So Mother Teresa's evil then, I guess, O'Reilly said, and Bill Maher said, notice that silence, that's what he said. He almost did the Porky Pig, abadi, 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 abadi. Because he was saying that religion produces evil. Organized religion especially, evil. People who think they're right, evil. Of course, you can find examples of that on the front page of the newspaper. The problem is there are thousands more examples of people who also believe they're religiously right, who are obviously not evil, and people like Bill Maher and Andrew Sullivan leave those out of the equation. They just pick the obvious examples. And the point here is it isn't that you think you're right. That's the problem. Bill Maher thinks he's right. Andrew Sullivan thinks he's right. Thomas Friedman thinks he's right. Nobody's neutral. To believe is to hold that the thing you believe about is so. Every belief entails a truth claim. We believe what we believe because we think we're right. Now, we may have various levels of certainty about that, but I don't detect any skepticism in Bill Maher's voice, or Rosie O'Donnell's voice, or Andrew Sullivan's voice. These people seem to be pretty certain about their views. Now, I don't fault them for their certainty, but they fault me on what they think is my certainty about my own views and others like me. I guess you can only be liberal. I mean, you can only be certain if you're on the left. Religiously speaking. By the way, you know who else was certain about his point of view? Martin Luther King. He was certain. You know who else was certain? Jesus of Nazareth. Now, Andrew Sullivan doesn't think so. He ends his piece talking about Jesus. But let me read a couple of quotes here. He starts out his piece by reflecting on the talk that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on the attitude, the sense of equanimity and peacefulness that this man displayed while he was in the West giving his speeches, and he asked himself, what is the source of his extraordinary calm? Why is he so at ease? And his answer was, Andrew Sullivan said, because, you know, religious certainty produces that kind of thing. He thinks he's right on his religious view, and so he can go about fomenting strife all over the planet and feel good about it because he feels he's got God on his side. And he says not only is it Mahmoud Ahmadinejad that has such equanimity and peace and can create strife all over the planet and feel good about it because he feels he's got God on his side, but he thinks that's true also of George Bush. He says that sense of certainty has even entered democratic politics in the United States. We have, after all, a proudly born-again president. Jimmy Carter was one, too, by the way. And religious certainty surely cannot be disentangled from George W. Bush's utter conviction that he has made no mistakes in Iraq. Now, I have to admit that I'm not the kind of guy who listens all the time to political punditry and conversation and debates and speeches. But the enforcer does. And as we were comparing notes today, I don't recall any time that George Bush ever justified anything he did in politics with some reference to God. Now, he does talk in terms of good and evil, but it seems to me that all leaders should be concerned about that. Religious certainty surely cannot be disentangled from George W. Bush's utter conviction that he has made no mistakes in Iraq. My faith frees me, the president once wrote. Frees me to make decisions that others might not like. Frees me to do the right thing even though I will not poll well. Frees me to enjoy life and not worry about what comes next. All right. Well, I guess Andrew Sullivan reads that as utter conviction that every step he's make is designed by God and that's why he's in Iraq and won't say he's sorry. But those aren't the reasons that George Bush gives for why he's in Iraq. He has policy concerns, and he's itemized those. Now, maybe Mr. Sullivan disagrees with them, but it's hardly a religious point of view that he's offered. Now, does he have religious conviction? Yes. Does this affect his state of mind? Well, sure, obviously. But, you know, I don't know what the alternative is here, friends. Ultimately, this can't be avoided, this kind of thing, that is, people making decisions based on convictions. Because if Andrew Sullivan were the president of the United States, what must he do? He must make difficult decisions, and he's got to make them based on reasons. And if he's deeply concerned about doing the right thing rather than the wrong thing, then he's going to take stock of his worldview, religious or otherwise, whatever it is that informs those decisions, and he's going to do what he thinks is right. And maybe that his convictions are very, very, very strong on those things, as they actually are in many other things. And he would make decisions. And I suspect that even if there's turmoil, which there is in these kinds of decisions, he could say, well, you know, I have strong convictions about what's right or wrong, and I can sleep well at night because I think I'm doing what's right. Now, what's wrong with that? Would we rather have a president scratching his head and say, gee, I don't know what's right and wrong. I'm going to try a couple things over here, and I'm going to try a couple things over there. And if I sound like Bill Clinton when I say that, it might be because that seems to be the way he dealt with things, or at least that's the sense a lot of people have about it. And here's a guy who's not equivocal like that. He's not putting his finger in the air every time. He's trying to do what's right. Now, it doesn't mean he's always right, but he's being faulted for that as a dangerous person, and I don't know what the alternative is. It's also not clear to me, by the way, that he has an utter conviction that he's made no mistakes in Iraq. But it certainly isn't because he thinks his public policy is divinely directed in its finer points, which is what Andrew Sullivan suggests here. So there seems to be a misrepresentation here of the president. And notice also the parity. between Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and George Bush. They're pretty much the same kind of guys. They're pretty much just as dangerous as the way this is being laid out. Now, Sullivan continues, many Western liberals and secular types look at the zealotry closing in on them and draw an obvious conclusion. Religion is the problem. That's Bill Maher's view, too, by the way. Religion's the problem. Is that the obvious conclusion that is appropriate to draw from what's going on today? Religion is the problem. I was at a prayer breakfast a couple of days ago. When was that? Was it last Thursday? Wednesday morning. Dennis Prager spoke, and he made an observation that, you know, it's not a profound observation in one sense. It ought to be the most ordinary thing, but it needs to be mentioned. For those like Andrew Sullivan who fear the so-called religious right because they have strong religious convictions and they think they're right, this country has been run by religious Christian fundamentalists for 200 years. And liberty has flourished. Why should we be afraid of them? Says Prager, a Jew. We have no need to be afraid of these people. Look at their history in this country. But it seems that Andrew Sullivan and others like him are petrified. By the way, the subtitle here, Andrew Sullivan on the Rise of Fundamentalism and Why Embracing Spiritual Doubt is the Key to Diffusing the Tension Between East and West. On the Rise of Fundamentalism. See, to people like this, all fundamentalism is the same. Since you have fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims, well, then they're both fundamentalists, so they're both just as bad. Well, this is a childish way of looking at words. You also could have fundamentalist Marxists. You could have fundamentalist Darwinists. You could have fundamentalist Catholics. You could have fundamentalist atheists. This is an adjective that has different content depending on which group you're describing as a fundamentalist, is the point that I'm making. There has been no rise of fundamentalism in this country, ladies and gentlemen. Fundamentalism has been the standard for 200 years, and the founding fathers, with very few exceptions, were what would be considered nowadays the worst kind of fundamentalism. And what did they deliver us? The American experiment and its subsequent success. This is nothing to be afraid of. I just realize I'm running out of time here for the first segment. There's so much here to talk about. But since no one's on the line here, maybe I'll keep talking. I guess I'll have to. After the break, 1-800-227-5278, area code 714, dial 754-4150, and I'll be glad to talk with you about this or anything else that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. I'm Greg Kokel. I'll be back in a moment.
Tired of defending your faith with, the Bible says so, does too, or I think it does? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
It is a rare opportunity to study under some of the finest minds in the field of Christian thought. We have collected a world-class team of Christian thinkers to give you the tools and skills you need to confidently defend the faith and to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to you as a follower of Christ. Our 2006 Master Series of Christian Thought set of lectures includes 5 excellent Christian teachers addressing timely topics to help you understand and address timely issues confronting Christian ambassadors. You can find out more about this unique training resource at our website, str.org, or call our office at 1-800-2-REASON. Learn from some of the sharpest minds in Christianity today. You'll be challenged and encouraged. The 2006 Master Series and Christian Thought Series is available at str.org.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokol giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 3 until 5 here on Stand to Reason, and you're welcome to talk with me at 1-800-227-5278. I'm reflecting right now on something that ought to be of deep concern to all who are followers of Christ, an article by Andrew Sullivan, When Not Seeing is Believing, and I just see this as one expression of a number, and increasingly so, those people who are deeply concerned about the certainty that they think religious people have. Now, this would be mostly Christian religious people in this country, because they think that is the serious problem. It's that certainty that's causing the difficulty. In fact, this is Andrew Sullivan's piece from Time Magazine, October 9th. When Not Seeing is Believing. And like I said, I think it's very well written and a powerful and I think compelling piece, but only compelling if you're not, how could I put this, clever enough to see the moves. Because this was thick with missteps of thinking. And as are these articles in general. But part of the point that I'm making here is the rise of fundamentalism that seems to alarm people like Andrew Sullivan is not a rise of fundamentalism at all, but a status quo of religious, of the idea that people could have religious knowledge, and therefore they were confident of their views because they thought religious truth could be known. And that's the way it's been for 200 years, and it's only been lately that that's changed. The irony, it's the emerging church Christians, or emergent Christians, however you want to dice that up, who have been frustrated with evangelical types because of their enlightenment-induced certainty for the last couple hundred years that can no longer be stomached by a postmodern crowd. Well, if that's true, and I think they're onto something there, then the certainty that Andrew Sullivan is writing about is not a resurgence. It is not a beginning. It is not a emergence. It is not a rise. It's always been there. And it's never been a problem. Not this kind of problem. In fact, it's created much good. It was religious people who were deeply certain about their convictions that largely contributed to the end of slavery, not only in this country but in the United Kingdom and that whole empire. In fact, it was principally, and one could say almost unilaterally, in the United Kingdom the result of Christian people who were certain. Domestically, Sullivan writes, listen to the words, the resurgence of religious certainty. Now, I've argued that there is no resurgence. It's the way it's always been. Domestically, the resurgence of religious certainty has deepened our cultural divisions. The resurgence of religious certainty has deepened our cultural divisions. And so our political discourse gets more polarized and our global discourse gets close to impossible. Well, certainly our political discourse has gotten more polarized, but it isn't because of a resurgence of certainty from religion, because that's always been around. Something else is new, and that is people like Andrew Sullivan. Now listen to the solution. And as I'm reading through this, I keep asking, okay, what's the solution? What's the alternative? What are you going to do? What you're complaining about is people on the right have strong convictions and act on those convictions. That's what you're complaining about. So would it be better that they didn't have convictions? Well, that's his solution. Here it is. There is a way out. The minds and souls of people of faith, I should say, it will come from only from one place, and that will be from the minds and souls of people of faith. So here's the way out. You people, you religious people have to change. The alternative to the secular fundamentalist death spiral is something called spiritual humility and sincere religious doubt. Fundamentalism is not the only valid form of faith, and to say it is the great lie of our time. Now, Mr. Sullivan has said something very dramatic. He has said that those who think they're right are wrong, and pluralists are right. Pluralists like him are right instead. Now, is that a divisive statement? Of course it is. He is drawing a line in the sand. It doesn't bother me, by the way. But it seems to be he's doing the very thing that he's complaining about fundamentalists doing. He's saying that fundamentalist claims to truth, the Muslims think that they're right, the Christians think that they're right, nobody's right, everybody's right. Fundamentalism is not the only valid form of faith. And to say it is the great lie of our time. It's a lie that all religion, that one religion is true. It is the truth that all are valid forms. Well, that's a religious claim that Mr. Sullivan thinks he's quite certain about, I presume, or else he wouldn't be writing this article. But that's a line in the sand, ladies and gentlemen. He's doing the very same thing he's claiming we ought not be doing. Doesn't bother me. I think we ought to be doing these things. I don't think there's anything wrong with certainty, but when it comes to religious certainty, those who are right of center should not be certain. It should be religious doubt, and he calls religious doubt, uncertainty, humility. It's not what humility is, by the way, but in any event, that's the way you characterize it. He says there is the faith that treats the Bible as a moral fable, as well as history. It tries to live its truths in the light of contemporary knowledge, history, science, and insight. There is the faith that sees the message of Jesus or Muhammad as a broad indicator of how we should treat others, of what profound holiness requires, and not as an account literally true in all respects that include an elaborate theology that explains everything. There is the dry deism of many Americans' founding fathers. That wouldn't be many, by the way. It would be few. And then he goes on to explain different ways of cashing out the religious project. But notice how he's saying it. There are many ways to cash out the religious project, not just one way. Do you see, friends, that that is a religious point of view? That is a point of view about religion. He's a pluralist. He's not an exclusivist. He thinks exclusivism is false and pluralism is right. He's making claims about religion that the details don't matter. There are these broad things that Jesus taught. You don't have to get onto the nitty-gritties about divisive creeds, doctrines. Well, by the way, Jesus, he says there's a faith that sees the message of Jesus and Muhammad as a broad indicator of how we should treat others. This person has not read Jesus carefully. Do you know that one-third of the Gospels, content-wise, focused on the passion of Christ? Why is that? Why does one-third, he has 3.5-year ministry, one-third deals with the last week of his life? Why? Why did they emphasize so much? Because that week was important. That isn't the week where he taught mostly about love and kindness. Actually, that was early Sermon on the Mount. No, it's because his death was really important in the detailed theology and picture of the world that Jesus himself held to. Andrew Sullivan continues with a really, I think, a foolish statement, but this is the postmodernism that's driving, I think, a lot of his point of view here. If God really is God, then God must, by definition, surpass all of our human understanding. Okay, true as far as it goes. In other words, if he's really God, he's going to be bigger than we're going to be able to understand. That is, we can't have omniscience about God. Good. And not entirely, he writes, and we have scripture, we have reason, we have religious authority, we have our own spiritual experiences of the divine, but there's still something we will never grasp. Something we can never know, because God is beyond our human categories. Fine, as far as it goes. And what follows from that? Here's what he thinks follows. If God is beyond our categories, then God cannot be captured for certain. Now, that doesn't follow. There can be some things that are beyond us with regards to God, even though there are some things we can have the highest degree of justification about, so much so that we can give our life for it. The writers of the New Testament talked about certainty. Read Acts chapter 2. Let all of the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you've crucified. There it is. It's certainly possible to have the highest level of confidence about some things, and just because we're not omniscient about God doesn't mean we can't be certain of some things. And he seems to be certain of things about God, even while he denies such certainty is possible. He writes, we cannot know him with the kind of surety that allows us to proclaim truth with a capital T. There will always be something that eludes us. If there weren't, it would not be God. And see, here's the mistake. If we can't know everything, then we can't know anything. We're not omniscient. I guess that's what he takes truth with the capital T to be, omniscience. But then we can't know anything. Well, listen, he just stated a truth about God with a capital T, that it is fully so. Even though he doesn't know everything, he seems to be very confident about this statement. That faith begins with the assumption that the human soul is fallible, that it can be delude itself, make mistakes, and see only so far ahead. Well, good. That, after all, is what is meant to be human. Okay. No person has the gift of omniscience. Okay, there's the problem. Yes, we have limited knowledge. No, we don't have omniscience, but that doesn't follow that we can't say there's some things that we can know as truth with capital T. The irony here is he puts this on Jesus. The skepticism that he's promoting, he puts on Jesus. He's not modeling skepticism, by the way. He's promoting it, though, with regards to the right, Christian right. The mystery that Christians are asked to embrace is not that Jesus was God, but that he was God made man, which is to say prone to the feelings and doubts and joys and agonies of being human. Jesus himself seemed to make a point of that. Jesus made a point of his doubts? I miss that. He taught in parables rather than in abstract theories. His parables were meant to clarify the truth, not to make things confusing. Although in some cases he told parables to keep those on the outside out, but on the inside he explained his parables so there wouldn't be this kind of confusion. He did have abstract principles, theories in mind. He told stories, he continues. He had friends. He got to places late. He misread the actions of others. Really, he misread the actions of others? I didn't catch that one either. He wept. Good. He felt disappointment. Okay. He asked as many questions as he gave answers. Yes, but he didn't ask questions because he was stupid. He used the Columbo tactic. He wasn't saying, gee, I don't know about this. Let me ask you a few questions. Maybe you can help me out. He wasn't the inquisitive type, friends. And he was often silent in self-doubt or elusive or afraid. I don't know. I've read a lot of Jesus, and I just don't get this picture of him that Andrew Sullivan did. And I guess Andrew Sullivan thinks that Jesus is this retiring religious agnostic and skeptic, and therefore we should be the same. Well, anyway, there's a whole bunch more here. I just don't have time to go into it. I want to get to your calls that are lining up here, but just one comment. Gosh. For those of you who are familiar with our principle, never read a Bible verse, you'll get a kick out of this one from Andrew Sullivan. Here now he's quoting Paul. Eye cannot see, says St. Paul, neither can it have entered into the heart of man the happiness which God hath prepared for them that love him. This he reads as a statement of doubt on Paul's part, uncertainty, agnosticism. We just don't know. By the way, a lot of Christians are guilty of quoting this verse in the same way. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, I believe, maybe 3. I cannot see, nor ear hear, nor has either entered into the heart of man all that God has prepared for those who love him, but these God has revealed to us, is the next verse. He talks about spiritual things in spiritual words. Paul is not saying we're in the dark in this passage. He is saying that God has taken these things out of the darkness and put them in plain language so that we can understand it. Read the text. Now, he does say that natural man doesn't make sense of this. It's foolishness to him because it's spiritually appraised. It's that passage he makes this comment. But he's not arguing here for agnosticism, not Paul. Shows me once again that Andrew Sullivan has not been reading his Bible very carefully. And then he diminishes Christianity to actions and not beliefs. It's the beliefs that show themselves in certain types of actions. And that's what a real Christian is. But he closes with a quote from German playwright Gotthold Lessing. If God were to hold all truth concealed in his right hand and in his left hand only the steady and diligent drive for truth, in other words, God says, okay, you could have all the truth here, or in the other hand, you could have the drive to get to the truth, albeit with the proviso that I would always and forever err in the process and to offer me the choice. I would with all humility take the left hand, that is, the search for truth rather than the truth itself. Because the pure truth is for you alone. Sullivan says that sentiment is as true now as it was more than two centuries ago when Lessing wrote it, except now the very survival of our civilization may depend on it. What Lessing is saying is, it's better to be on the search for truth than to have the truth. Why would anybody search for what he could never have? Only a fool would do that. But that's exactly the recommendation Andrew Sullivan is giving to us who are followers of Jesus. Yet Jesus himself did not offer that recommendation. He said, I came to bear witness to the truth. Father, sanctify them in truth, because my word is truth. I'm Greg Kokel. After the break, we'll just go right straight through with your calls. Please don't go away. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material too by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition,
all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes two DVDs and one data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Giving you something worth thinking about every weekend. 3 until 5 Los Angeles time. That's for you podcasters who are thinking about calling in. Podcast recipients, I should say, or listeners. As is our first caller, so let's go directly to him. And Dave, thank you for waiting. I appreciate that.
Hello. How you doing, Greg?
Doing fine. Calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Got a quick question, but before I do give the quick question, I just want to just thank you real briefly. I've heard you about 9 months now since I first heard you on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and my response at the time was, where have you been for the last 15 years of my life?
Well, that's really sweet. I have to tell you, quite frankly, sometimes we at Stand to Reason ask ourselves the same question with regards to the greater population, because Frank Beckwith said we're one of the best-kept secrets in the country, and we're not sure how to change that. But we are praying about it and working really hard, and we're just waiting for the opportunity that God would give for more exposure. But we're glad that you found us, Dave.
Yeah, I sure am. And,
tell your
really,
friends.
Right now, I feel like your ministry is like a – it's like a teacher to me. It's like a mentor, a remote mentor to me in a sense, because I appreciate the way you work through the issues, even the issues that you're not, let's say, 100% on, but just the way you thought process. It helps mm-hmm. me to clarify my thinking.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. Thank you. You know, part of my feeling about sometimes I don't know the answer to a problem, but I can tell some of the things that aren't good answers and therefore trim the field down a little bit, and then you can work at it from there.
And now my biggest problem right now
okay.
is actually having – I'm in the process of searching for a home church. And since I've listened to your series on the decision-making and the will of God, I had the hardest time trying to leave the church I was before then.
Uh-huh.
I wish I had that tape before I left the church. But anyway, I did make the decision and found your tape afterwards.
I see. Okay. Was that – were you going to one of the Stanley churches there in Atlanta area?
No, it wasn't.
Pastor Stanley?
No, it wasn't. It was one of those. It was another kind of Pentecostal type.
I see. Okay, because Pastor Stanley, both the father and the son, Pastors Stanley, I think hold a view opposite mine there, and
that's
right. Okay, so have you found it? Did you want to talk about the churches you found, or do you have some other issue?
No, some other issue, but
okay.
I'm still searching for the church. But
yeah,
after being exposed, your ministry is making it more difficult.
Well, Dave, let me offer just a word on this, and I'll let you get to your question. But this is for a lot of people who are listening. You're never going to find a church that agrees with everything, and what's important is to find a church that, by and large, has a high view of Scripture and seems to follow it pretty much, and if you're going to try to find a church in which the pastor has no leanings whatsoever towards hearing from God in any sense, then I think it's going to be very difficult to find a church that you could attend, because so many pastors are taken with this, and so much of Christendom is given to this way of thinking. Now, what I have chose to do, what I'm looking for is a pastor that, you know, and he may have this lurking in the background, and every once in a while you hear statements like this, but it isn't like right there in the forefront, and they're not making decisions for their church every time you turn around, what is God telling us to do, and that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't exhibit the kind of wisdom that would bring stability to that church community. So you're going to have to probably, simply put, make a compromise on that issue, and just make sure you find a pastor or a church leadership that, even if they are got one ear to heaven a little bit, they are demonstrating wisdom in the decisions that they are making, and that they are actually consistent with Scripture by and large.
Yes.
Make your job easier. Okay, what else is on your mind here, Dave? Okay,
good. Appreciate it. The question today is, I was listening to your archive some time ago, and you mentioned something about you know, in the past, under when Israel was under theocracy, there's a host of crimes that were punishable by capital punishment.
That's correct. There's, I think, 12 or 13 of them.
Yes.
Maybe
but
more.
Now for, good. Yeah, and for now, most of those, we don't longer, in our society, it's no longer a capital crime.
Correct.
And one of your comments was, well, one reason for that is because we're no longer under theocracy. So in a sense, rule has kind of changed.
Well, after fashion, that's a good way of putting it. You'll note that when you look at those particular crimes that were capital punishments, the majority of them were religious crimes.
Yes.
And so there was, under the theocracy, that was appropriate. But these aren't crimes that had any meaning in a non-theocratic civil government, those religious crimes. And so consequently, when the religious significance is removed from that particular set of circumstances, obviously then the capital punishment is no longer applicable. In fact, those things aren't even a crime anymore. Jews were expected to keep the Sabbath, and the punishment for Sabbath breaking was capital punishment. But Gentiles were not expected to keep the Sabbath, and so if they weren't expected to keep it, then there's no violation. If there's no violation, there's no punishment.
Oh, okay.
That's the sense that I was getting at when I mentioned that. I mean, it may raise other questions, but does that clarify things for you a little bit?
Yeah, it does. It does, because I was making the jump that, well, since we're no longer in theocracy, well, why do we still do capital punishment for murder?
Okay, let me answer that, because some people are asking that question, and I think that there's a very, very good answer, and it's actually a fairly straightforward answer. I use my reference to the Hebrew law and those capital crimes initially and almost solely to indicate that God himself is not against capital punishment. God himself is not against capital punishment, because he instituted capital punishment under a certain time of history. Now, and under a certain set of circumstances. So the point I'm making, there are Roman Catholic churches against capital punishment on principle, and so are other Christians. They're against it on principle. They think that capital punishment per se in itself is wrong and immoral. And my response is, it can't be immoral in itself when God himself ordained it at one point in time. Now, it may not apply now for other reasons, but I'm trying to disabuse people of that leg of their anti-capital punishment stance. Now, like I said, they may be able to make a case on other grounds, but this is not a sound leg to stand on, okay? God's not a pacifist, and God is not against capital punishment per se. Now, it might be that Jesus' teachings precludes capital punishment today or something like that. That's a different argument. I don't think that works either, but I'm raising the fact of capital punishment under the theocracy to show that God couldn't be, that it can't be inherently immoral. But there's another observation here that makes it clear not only that it's not immoral, but it does have application even to Gentile cultures, because capital punishment was not instituted. It was not initiated, I should say, in the Hebrew law. It was initiated before there was any law. It was initiated even before Abraham. It was initiated with God and Noah in Genesis chapter 9. And here's what God said. If man sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God, God created man. Now, this is a very important verse in a couple of counts. The first is, it's clear that this was given to a Gentile person, not a Jewish person, all right? Capital punishment isn't just found in the theocracy, and now that we're outside of the theocracy, then capital punishment is no longer defensible. It's actually comes before the theocracy, Genesis 9. And there we also get the rationale. It is precisely from this, again, from God's perspective, and I'm talking with you as a fellow Christian, so that, you know, I wouldn't talk this way so much with non-Christians, but for those in kind of who share this belief system and understand the Bible to be the Word of God, keep in mind Genesis 9 was from God too, and there God said that capital punishment was legitimate for a particular reason. It is precisely because of the value of human beings, that when you take the life of a human being, you sacrifice your own. Okay, and so the rationale is tied to human dignity, and some people say, "Are you saying that you affirm human dignity, affirm a life by destroying life?" I say that's exactly right. That's precisely what God is saying there. Now you can read it yourself and see if I've mistook it, but it seems to me that the justification for a capital punishment is because of the seriousness of the crime. And there's another leg to this for me with secular governments. And I'm arguing only now that capital punishment is not precluded. I'm not arguing that it has to be instituted in every case. I'm saying that it's a legitimate alternative. Here, one, from a biblical perspective, a Christian perspective, we have a theological grounding in that human beings are made in the image of God, and it's for this reason that God said that when they take a life, they sacrifice their life. That's the only way we can affirm the full value of human life. From God's perspective. The second thing is there's a secular understanding too. This principle, by the way, that I'm offering in just a moment comes from the scriptures, but it's one that's understood by people who don't have revelation. It's called lex talionis. Have you heard this term before?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's the law of the talon or the law of the claw. And it's a term used to describe, it's a legal phrase used to describe the idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, people, I think, have misunderstood this notion because of some things that Jesus said about it. But principally, it is a principle that says that the punishment should be proportionate to the crime. If you commit a crime at a certain level, you should be punished in a way that's appropriate for that level of the crime. You don't cut somebody's hand off for stealing a loaf of bread, kind of deal. Okay?
Makes sense.
Okay, and so that's called the law of the claw, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, people have misused that in the time of Jesus, and he spoke against the abuse of it. But it's actually a principle of justice. And so based on the principle of justice, I would argue that capital punishment is legitimate because murder is a capital crime and capital punishment is an appropriate punishment for that level of crime. You take a life, you give a life. It's something along that line. So foundationally, capital punishment ought to be a legitimate consideration because it reflects justice. It seems meet for the crime that was committed. And therefore, it should not be dismissed out of hand as something barbaric. Rather, arguably, in a sense, I wouldn't say it's not more barbaric, but it's an act of injustice to say a guy take somebody else's life, but we're not going to take his in return. We'll keep him in prison for the rest of his life or a portion of his life, and call that even when it's not at all. Some people say, well, that's just rank. What do you call it when you get back at somebody else? That's
revenge.
Revenge. That's revenge. Well, okay, you can call it revenge if you want, but it's an appropriate kind of revenge. It is an appropriate getting back. And it's the getting back that God actually gave the power to do so to human government. And this is clear in the New Testament. God has ordained government for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do right. Now, if God says the governments have his authority, you know, don't take your own vengeance. Leave God the vengeance. Well, that means we shouldn't personally be taking vengeance. But one of the ways that God takes vengeance is through the established authority that he set up, and that's government. And so the question then is, if government is supposed to take a measure of God's vengeance, should they do it with equanimity and justice? And the answer is yes. If we're going to be doing justice for God, we should be doing it. In a balanced and an appropriate way, and that legitimizes the possibility of capital punishment to me. It doesn't disallow it. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir, it does.
Yeah.
I am pro-capital punishment. I was just trying to think through some of the potential argument against it.
Right, and I hope that – I mean, I kind of laid out my rationale in the principles so you can kind of sink your teeth into those and run with those and work with them a little bit. And by the way, if we are not to take our own revenge – and that means no capital punishment, then no punishment is allowable under those circumstances. Not any, not one day in prison, not 5 cents of fine. Because any kind of punishment then could be viewed as taking our revenge, which Jesus and God says we shouldn't do. Now, I think that's a misunderstanding. Dave, it was very good talking to you. I'm glad we've had such an impact on you over the years. And tell your friends. I'll be back. Hour number two, Stand to Reason. 1-800-227-5278. Don't go away. Greg Kokel, stand to reason, friends. Welcome to the School of Clear Thinking Christianity. We are, of course, committed to clearing up mental smog. There's a whole lot of it here, not just in Southern Cal. But it is becoming more and more critical that we are careful in our thinking about the most important things with a culture that's coming down around our ears. Last hour, I started out talking about Andrew Sullivan's article, When Not Seeing is Believing. You need to read it. It is prescient. That means it foretells the future. It is portentous. Time, October 9th, 2006. That's where it was published. I don't know if this, what's today? Today's the 8th, so it's this week. The Time magazine on the stands right now, but you might probably get it on the World Wide Web. Andrew Sullivan, a leading homosexual activist in this country and part of the Cognoscenti. He's a bright guy, and he writes very well. And this piece is an example of that, but it's very deceptive and misleading and deeply fallacious in ways that he doesn't see. I wasn't able to cover all the problems, but you can. And you need to get used to understanding what's going on in articles like these, because you are the enemy, according to him, if you're a follower of Christ and you are, and you think you're right. He wants followers of Christ that are agnostic and skeptics, because he thinks that's kind of the way Jesus was. Saturday and Sunday, the 21st and 22nd of this month, I'll be at Pacific Coast Church in San Clemente. We don't have a topic yet, but I'll be there on 5 p.m. on Saturday night, and then both the 9 and 10:45 services on Sunday. If you want the contact number, 949 area code, 940-2600. 949-940-2600. Also, Melinda, we need to tell on the show in advance when I'm going to be in out-of-town places, because we've got a lot of podcasters around the country, and sometimes they pick up on it at the last minute and show up, and that's always kind of a treat, so I have to mention that. I mentioned last hour that I was at a prayer breakfast that Dennis Prager spoke at. I was actually supposed to be on the dais and part of that program. There was a last-minute change, and I was instead sitting in with the rest of the group, but I was very happy to be part of, just listen to what Prager had to say. But I actually had been originally asked to give the invocation at the end, praying for our country. Now, I want to get back to calls. What happened to them? They disappeared. Okay, 1-800-227-5278. And the 714 area code, 754-4150. We had a number of people on. I was going to jump right to you, but you went bye-bye. So lines wide open, and you're welcome to jump on board and be glad to talk to you. I was facing a difficult situation. Well, first I was asked to do this invocation, okay? And I was glad to do it. It turned out this was a massive enterprise. It was at the – there were 1,400 people there for breakfast in Anaheim. The mayor, Hugh Hewitt, was the MC for that morning, and it was a great event. And a lot of good things were said, and my suspicion is many followers of Christ were in that. But there was a mixed crowd, and you always had a little bit of a liability when you're asked to pray at a civic event. Because of the press of political correctness. In fact, I recall a news piece not too long ago where someone was asked to pray, and then he prayed a Christian prayer. He was a Christian, after all. And that got him in a lot of trouble. He was called intolerant. Now, you know what I think about that kind of stuff. This twisting of tolerance. It seems to me that if a Christian is asked to pray in an event, then the Christian should pray in a way that's consistent with his conscience. He should pray a Christian prayer. I don't think it is – well, I guess it depends a little bit on how it's done. But, you know, if you pray one of these generalized prayers to everybody's God and the God that everybody worships, and pray the kind of prayer that everybody's going to be happy with because it's all-inclusive – well, then you've actually prayed a prayer that is inconsistent with your own religious convictions. And but, of course, now the deal is you got to pray according to somebody else's conscience, not according to your own, or else that's politically incorrect. Used to be that if you offered a prayer, then you prayed according to your view. And if there were people there that didn't pray like you or didn't even believe in God, didn't pray at all, then they just sat there and watched this word, tolerated you. They tolerated you. They put up with you, if you want to use that way of putting it. But that's what it amounts to. They don't agree, but they're not going to moan and complain and whine like a bunch of babies. They're going to say, all right, well, he's a Christian, or he's a Jew, he's a Muslim, he's a, you know, spiritist, or, you know, he's a chanter or whatever, Native American. And so they do things differently than I do. So I will respectfully wait until he's done. That's called tolerance. Now, if you say anything that is inconsistent with somebody else's views, it's not all-encompassing. People say, that's intolerant. And in fact, this preacher had done this. He'd prayed for our country and very aggressively in the name of Jesus, and he got all kinds of heat. So when I get asked to do something like this, I got to figure out, how am I going to deal with this? Because I want to pray genuinely. I don't want to give in to the political correctness, but at the same time, I don't want to start a fight if I can avoid it. And so I planned to offer an introduction to my prayer that would kind of pave the road and appeal to tolerance in order to avoid the charge of intolerance. And I put it all together, and I was pretty happy with it, and then it turned out I didn't have to do my job, but I am keeping this introduction to my invocation for future reference in case I get asked again somewhere. But it occurred to me that some of you might be in the same place that I was in, and you'll want to know how you can get away with praying according to your conscience and not giving in to political correctness. And so we're going to post this piece. It's called Prayer Breakfast Invocation. It actually should be Prayer Breakfast Invocation Introduction, basically, but you'll understand it. And if you wanted to look on our website later this week, you'll find it, and you're free to use it. But here's what I wrote down. So in other words, when I get up to give the invocation, my first comments are, you know, I understand that prayers at events like these can be controversial, and the pressure is great to offer an invocation that everyone will be comfortable with. But since there's a large diversity of beliefs and non-beliefs here, I realize that simply is not possible. So since I've been asked to offer the prayer this morning, and since I'm a Christian, I will pray in a way that's consistent with my conscience. And you are welcome to enter in if you like, or simply quietly wait for me to finish as you wish. And I thank you in advance for your understanding and your tolerance if your particular way of praying, or not praying as the case may be, is different from mine. And then you can pray your prayer, whatever it is. So you are welcome to use this if it will help you if you ever find yourself in that place. But notice how what I've done is I've taken the tolerance trick and I've twisted around and used it in a way that keeps me from being charged with intolerance. And that is necessary under circumstances like these. All right, let's go to Ray. Oh, I guess I'm not going to go to Ray quite yet. Can I? Wait, just a sec. Oh, I can go? Okay, I can go to Ray. Ray in Escondido. Ray in Escondido, welcome to Stand to Reason. Thanks for waiting.
Hey. Hi. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing all right. What's up?
I just wanted to comment on this man, Andrew, that you were reading. You've reading his article.
Yeah, Andrew Sullivan, right, from Time Magazine's When Not Seeing Is Believing.
Mm-hmm. I think that we Christians need to pray for these people because more than what I got out of the article was that he was writing more about his not wanting to repent of his sin as a homosexual. It really has little to do with the politics of the United States. And the Lord, you know, this guy represents an enemy on a spiritual level, an enemy of Christians and Christianity. And we Christians need to just understand that we need to pray for these people.
Well, I agree with that, Ray, that we ought to be praying with them. I want to just reflect for a minute.
No, not with them, praying for them.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Pray for them. My mind was running ahead just a little bit. So I want to agree with you that we should be praying for them, all right?
Yeah.
Now, and I think that there is certainly a sense in which this man is an enemy. Now, of course, here's the difficulty with making that comment, and part of my reason I went over this is I want Christians like you to be, and me really, to be aware of this trend and not to be scared away, obviously, to keep our hand at the plow, as it were, but also to be aware so that we can be careful and we can be wise. I would not be inclined to speak very aggressively publicly about this man being an enemy to us Christians. And the reason why is that language, I'm going to offer an alternative way of putting it in just a moment, but that kind of language plays directly into his fears. Here he's arguing that right-wing Christians think they're right and they are militant and they are dangerous. And then when he says this publicly, then Christians say, he's our enemy.
Now, okay, now hold on. I didn't say he was our enemy. I said he was our enemy spiritually.
Yeah, Ray, I'm with you on this. I don't disagree with your sentiments. I don't disagree at all. I'm just talking about the way we describe ourselves. Mm-hmm. We talk about these circumstances in public because, yeah, he is our enemy spiritually. But
or he represents that, our enemy is really what I said. He represents our enemy.
What we need to ask ourselves is what are our people, other people going to be hearing when we make these kind of comments?
Well, that's
you also
kind of
said we should
be correct, isn't it?
Yes, but it's not enough just to be correct.
That's
there's a lot of things
correct.
That we can say
to
that
worry
could,
about what other people think about us is kind of doing the politically correct thing.
No, well, that's not exactly what I'm asking for. I'm asking for something a little different. It isn't that I don't want people to think badly about me. What I don't want people to be doing is reacting to the wrong things. So I'm going to be choosing my words as carefully as I can. So if they're reacting, they're reacting to something that's really important. So if they're saying to us, you guys are dangerous because you think you're right and you're going to blow things up. And then they hear me saying, you are the enemy. Well, if they already have that idea in mind, then they think I'm going to blow them up right now. I think that this point of view definitely is that people who promote these ideas are enemies to the cross of Christ. There is a spiritual battle that's going on here. There's no question about that. It's good that you said we ought to pray for this guy, but a lot of times you said we should pray for him. We should not blow him up, but they don't always hear those things, and so we want to be alert to how they're listening. And so it doesn't mean we're always going to be able to put it in a way that they won't be able to mistake it or distort it, but at least we want to be as sensitive to that as possible.
Okay. Well, Greg, I think what you've done is you've kind of like completely got off track because I can talk to you. You're a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You understand that this guy represents our enemy. But what I'm my main point is Christians need to not only pray for these people, but they probably ought to write into their editors of newspapers and explain that we are praying for these people. We don't hate homosexuals.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Right.
But it's time to stop fighting with them, and it's time to start praying for them. They're sick.
Okay, when you say we stop fighting, you say we should not be addressing these issues that he brought up?
Oh,
okay.
Oh, now you're trying to misconstrue what I've said.
No, Ray, I'm asking you a question. I'm not misconstruing anything. If I were misconstruing it, I'd make the statement. I'm asking the question so that I understand you.
No, I'm not. That's the answer. No, I am not saying that we don't stand up against them.
Okay.
Getting on the radio and bashing them is not the right thing to do either.
Oh,
getting on the radio and saying, brothers and sisters out there, this is what we're facing, and, you know, we need to pray for these people. That's how we need to handle it.
Okay, so did you think that I was bashing him? Is that when you said we shouldn't be getting on the radio bashing him, was that a...
Hey, I thought you were bashing him? My goodness.
Ray, that's why I'm asking the question.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thanks, Ray, for the call. Just an observation. Ray hung up on himself, but he did say goodbye. It's hard to know what people are thinking when they make the statements they're making. So when I'm on the radio having a full discourse, 20 minutes, talking about Andrew Sullivan, and then I get a caller who gets in and says, one thing we shouldn't be doing is getting on the radio and bashing these people. We should be praying for them. Now, it sounds to me like he's suggesting I shouldn't be talking the way I've just been talking for 20 minutes, but rather should be telling you to pray for them. Now, I don't know what you were thinking when you heard that comment, but that was, that seems to me a natural way to take it. However, I wasn't willing to just assume that was the case. I thought I'd test it out, so I wasn't mischaracterizing him in my own mind, and that's why I asked the question. Unfortunately, Ray took umbrage with the question itself, as if I was putting that on him. I wasn't at all. I think most of you understand the point that I was trying to make, and that is, all right, yes, we should pray about these people, although I didn't quite understand what he meant by we shouldn't be fighting them, but we should be writing letters to the editor saying, we're praying for these sinners, or however he put it, but that sounded like the sense of it. I don't know, writing to the letters to the editor saying we're praying for these people is going to do any good at all. And I guess I didn't quite understand these other recommendations and the legitimacy or the effectiveness of them. But in any event, certainly praying is good. But these other actions, instead of attacking on radio, what I was trying to do is use this as a foil, in part for a clear thinking exercise. Secondly, to help you all realize the sophisticated ways that those out there are attacking Christianity and some of the flaws in their attack, and for you to be alert and aware to these kinds of things, so that not so that we run away and not that we disengage, but that we stay steady at the helm and be wise in the way we engage. And if I understand what Ray and I are having a conversation here, fine. I wasn't troubled by his conversation with me, but it was a subtle, it was a warning that we got to be careful we don't talk like this in public, because it would be misleading. I understood what he was saying, but everybody else isn't going to understand. I heard him say we should pray for him, but everybody else isn't going to hear that. They're going to hear enemy, enemy, enemy. There are enemies. I mean, that was the sense I took. Now, he said I misquoted him. Maybe I did, but if I misquoted him, it's because I misunderstood him. And if I misunderstood him, a whole lot of other people are going to misunderstand that kind of language too, which is my point. I think I was pretty direct with Andrew Sullivan and his content and his ideas, and I think that's appropriate. But we want to be aware that this is the way they're seeing us, and we want to not fall into the trap of sounding like the people they're describing us to be. That's not being politically correct. That's being wise, it seems to me. 1-800-227-5278, 714 area code 754-4150, and Mark in Bakersfield, thanks for your call.
Tired of defending your faith with the Bible says so, does too, or I think it does. Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
It is a rare opportunity to study under some of the finest minds in the field of Christian thought. We have collected a world-class team of Christian thinkers to give you the tools and skills you need to confidently defend the faith and to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to you as a follower of Christ. Our 2006 Master Series of Christian Thought set of lectures includes 5 excellent Christian teachers addressing timely topics to help you understand and address timely issues confronting Christian ambassadors. You can find out more about this unique training resource at our website, str.org, or call our office at 1-800-2-REASON. Learn from some of the sharpest minds in Christianity today. You'll be challenged and encouraged. The 2006 Master Series and Christian Thought Series is available at str.org.
Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, the place where you get the other side, the truth, something worth thinking about every Sunday. And congratulations to James Crotty in Erie, Pennsylvania. He is our Frapper winner this week. We'll be sending a book to him shortly. James, congratulations. And, of course, what that means is, James, it was a name we picked out of the hat, as it were, because he is one of our Frapper listeners. Frapper is a map where you can put your pin, a little flag that shows where you live and that you're a listener to stand to reason. And if you want to be part of that drawing, just go to str.org and punch our little button in the lower left-hand corner for podcasting, and you'll see a map come up and just follow the instructions. But it gives us an idea of what our listening audience is, or kind of our insiders around the world, and a lot of you call on a regular basis. But if you go ahead and put your pin in there, you will be eligible for the drawing that we do every week. So congratulations to James Crotty in Erie, Pennsylvania, our Frapper winner this week. Now, at the end of the last segment, I was kind of misreading a name here. I said Mark from Bakersfield, you're up, but you're coming in just a moment, Mark, so hang on there. Going to Brian in San Diego. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Brian.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
I want to say thanks so much for all that you do. You're a true blessing to all of your listeners.
Thank you.
And since you've been around longer than I have, I'm wondering a couple questions related to the Sullivan letter.
Yeah.
Would you say that you've noticed an increase in animosity towards Christians over the years? And,
well,
and then I'll ask a couple of questions in case
fine. I think the answer to that is publicly yes, and this is part of the point that I'm making, that the public rhetoric is heating up against Christians. Now, I can't say that I have been the recipient of a lot of that hostility. In fact, when I've gone into secular environments, I've gotten very little hostility. When I was at Berkeley a couple of years ago, I got great treatment. But keep in mind, I posture as a stand to reason person. In other words, I follow kind of our guidelines for engaging people, and so I don't think I'm as likely as some to push the wrong buttons, and I think that's helped me. But I think that it is certainly the case that political correctness and postmodernism and all of this stuff has had a great influence to make the follower of Jesus Christ look much more dangerous. Not as many people were calling evangelicals dangerous 5-10 years ago, and now they're really doing it a lot. And so I think the political rhetoric, the public rhetoric, has increased. In Sullivan's example, Sullivan is just another example of that.
It seems to me that Sullivan seems to take the mentality that's espoused in The Last Temptation of Christ and the book that that's from regarding Christ's self-doubt. I'm wondering if you can comment any further on that also.
Well, I don't know about the book, but I know about the movie, and I know that that was part of the movie. I know some people make a lot of the phrase, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? I think I don't think it's as mysterious as many people take it. Jesus was quoting from the Psalms. I think it was Psalm 20-something. I'll have to look it up. But he was quoting from the Psalms, and there's much in that Psalm that has to do with the crucifixion. And I think that's the answer to why Jesus said what he said comes from taking a closer look at that Psalm. Other than that, I don't know where they're getting all of this information about Jesus, who is so doubtful and skeptical and uncertain and lost and all this other stuff. I think that Jesus had tremendous confidence, tremendous certainty, and we see this in almost everything that he did. That would be Psalm 22. So you can't read Jesus. I mean, read his life story in the accounts that we have from the people who were there, the best and really only detailed historical references that we have, and come to the conclusion that Sullivan has come to, apparently, about Jesus' teaching. He was afraid. He was doubtful. He got it wrong. He wasn't listening. He misunderstood people. All these other – he's just like you and I, basically. Come on. And so if he's like that, you are claimed to be a follower of his, then you shouldn't be any more than what Jesus was. It's just a misunderstanding. It's not even a misunderstanding of Jesus. Jesus can't be taken that way if you read him. All you have to do is read him. It isn't like he can be read in different ways. Jesus wasn't this shrinking violet, for goodness sake. He was deeply confident of his views. He understood he was going to die. He set his face resolutely towards Jerusalem. He predicted his own death. So when we read about him on the cross, we can't read into him all of this uncertainty. Like, this is a surprise to him. So I think he just got it wrong.
Yeah, I would fully agree. It seems that there, the what is frequently termed as the left is just attempting to try and make their position seem more rational by coming up with these ideas of, oh, well, your idol, the way that they may put it, is as far as Jesus, is just as skeptical as we are. So
right.
Get a grip and get off your high horse.
Sure. If you're going to be a follower of Jesus, act like him. Be skeptical. Well, yeah, this is it's just part of the trend today. And it's very common for people on both sides of the aisle, by the way, but more on the other side, I think, to cherry pick about Jesus. Sullivan does it here in his article. People do it all the time. That is, they find the verses that they like. And then they focus in on those, and they make their whole theology about that. You cannot read the Bible, even as a work of literature, the Gospels, if you consider the writers and what they intended, and conclude that Jesus was just about love and peace and forgiveness and living a good life. Not when one-third of the Gospels, by each of the writers, covers just the last week of his life. They each understood the significance of that last week, and it had little to do with us loving our neighbor. It had to do with God's love for us by sending a sacrifice in the form of his son Jesus. And that's why at the end of virtually every gospel, we have something like a Great Commission, which tells the disciples to go out and carry that message to the world. So that's the ending of it. And John doesn't have the Great Commission, but he does have that the end of chapter 20 or 21. It says that these signs were given and written in this gospel so that you would believe that Jesus was the Son of God and have life in his name. So they all end on the same theme, that Jesus is the Savior of the world to save the world from their sins. And there is good reason to believe that that's the case. They all end on the same theme. Why didn't it end with saying that Jesus died a good teacher and he left a message of us all of love and kindness and forgiveness and tolerance? They don't all say that. None of them say that. It's because that wasn't his message, you know. So I don't know where they're getting this, but I do think they're trying to read it in a way that's consistent with their own ideas.
I would fully agree.
Okay, buddy. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, Brian from San Diego. Let's go now to Bakersfield. And Mark, thank you for your patience, Mark.
Oh, hey, no problem. I have kind of a three-part question for you.
Okay.
What is the difference between Calvinism and Arminianism?
Okay.
Can you recommend a good book that kind of goes deep into it? And is it really important whether I subscribe to one belief or the other?
Oh, gosh. All right, first difference is, and I think, let me give you the difference that I think matters
okay.
to most people in the discussion.
Right.
Keep in mind that Calvinism is – there's a movement in Christianity called the Reformation, and the Reformation held largely to a coherent set of understandings about salvation, and those people are called the Reformed, okay? And the Reformed – Calvin was one of those who represented the Reformed view. The Reformed view is larger than Calvin, though. In a way that Lutheranism is not larger than Luther. Luther and Lutheranism are the same, but the Reformed view and Calvin are not quite the same. Now, if you're a Calvinist, and what you mean is you're a follower of Calvin, well, then Calvin's the man to you. But usually the word Calvinism is meant to capture this larger point of view that's called the Reformed point of view. And Reformed point of view has a particular understanding I think carefully articulated by a number of its writers, of how the Salvation Project works. And simply put, the Calvinist or the Reformed person believes that election is unconditional, where the Arminian believes that election is conditional. Now, election has to do with getting with God's, and I'm going to put quotes around this word here because it's understood differently by each side, with God choosing who is going to be saved, all right? According to the Reformed tradition, God's choice is unilateral, and therefore the word election is used to describe it because election is unilateral. That is, when we elect somebody here in 4 weeks, for some of the people that are running, it is the electors that elect the electee. The electee doesn't elect himself, all right?
Right.
And that's the way Calvinist or Reformed people view God's sovereign grace, that God gives his grace to whom he wills. He is not obliged by anything or anyone to distribute his grace in any particular way, and he has chosen to distribute it to those whom he pleases, and those group are called the elect. And what makes the elect, on the Calvinist view, is God's sovereign unilateral choice. And therefore, since it's God's choice and it's unilateral, it's something that he does, it's therefore unconditional. There is no further thing that God conditions his choice on, like he halfway chooses you if you do something else, and then that kind of puts the whole thing together, and then you're in. On the Calvinist view, if God chooses, then it's done with. Now, how that plays itself out and the means that God uses to accomplish that is a different issue, but it is unconditional election, where an Arminian believes in election because the Bible teaches election. But he believes it's conditional. It's conditional on something. It's not just God. It's something else. And usually what goes along with Arminian is a view of free will that is called libertarian free will that says that man's choice is what makes the final decision, where God can only go so far in offering or does only go so far in offering and wooing and cajoling. Ultimately, it is the person's own choice determines whether they, the person's own libertarianly free choice that determines whether they become Christians or not. God will not interfere with that libertarian decision. It is up to us, and that's the long and short of it. And therefore, many Arminians say you can choose Christ and you can unchoose him too. Not all will say that, but there are some who believe in, eternal security after you make your choice for God. Now, the way election works in this circumstance, then, is that the way God elects is his election is conditional. He foreknows those who will choose him. He knows in advance that, say, if you're a Christian, that you will choose him. So in virtue of his foreknowledge that he knows you're going to choose him, then he elects you. And that's a simple way of putting it, but notice how the election there is conditional as opposed to unconditional. And that is the watershed between Reformed or Calvinist thinkers and Arminian thinkers. Now, there is a thing called the TULIP, the T-U-L-I-P, that are five defining doctrines, only one of which is unconditional election, and that is on the Calvinist side, that is opposed on the Arminian side. But you can refine it more. But I think for the rank and file, the defining, distinguishing feature is whether conditional or unconditional election. Now, there are books out that have like both sides argued, and you can check those out. I recommended a book a couple of weeks ago, and I couldn't remember the title, but I remembered it now. It's called Elect in the Sun, and now I can't remember the guy's name, Jack Rank, or I can't think of it. Is it Elect
Jack
in the
Sun?
Yeah. Elect in the Sun? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that is the title of the book. You should be able to find it if you type it into Google or just in Amazon or something. And I was told by other Calvinists who I respect that this is one of the best characterizations of the Arminian view that can be found. So Elect in the Sun. And there's a number of others. R.C. Sproul has written a book. Michael Horton has written a book on election. There are quite a number of – I think James White has written a book, so there's a number of them out there on the Calvinist side that are popular. But Sproul might be the best.
Okay.
R.C. Sproul, S-P-R-O-U-L.
Right. Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
Okay.
Great.
And it doesn't make a difference. Does it make a difference? I think yes, but I'm not going to draw a line in the sand on this one. I think it's important. I think it helps encourage people about God. I think every Christian should engage the ideas there. But if you're going to sit on the fence, I mean, I understand that. But I think you should at least engage the ideas. Okay.
Great. I'm looking at Amazon right now. It says "Elect in the Sun" is by Robert Shank.
Shank. There you go, Robert Shank.
A
got it.
Study in the Doctrine of Election.
Okay. There
and
you
that
go.
Kinda, so that kind of covers both, or
no? No, that's the Arminian side.
That's the Arminian side. Okay, yeah. And then R.C. Sproul would be more the Calvinist.
There you go.
A Reformed side.
That's right.
Great.
You got it right, Mark. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Great talking to you in Bakersfield. Let's go to Neil. Do we have time for this? Yes. Okay. 1-800-227-5278, by the way. We have open lines in the 714 area code 754-4150, and we have 25 minutes left, so I'm sure we'll get to you if you call. Neil in Long Beach. Hi.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
Pretty good. I got a frog in my throat. I'm going to clear it. Go ahead and talk.
Okay. Yeah. First, I agree with you that it just because we don't – there's a difference between telling people what we want to hear and being careful about the way we say things.
Thank you. That was kind of the point that I was trying to get across, but our caller didn't kind of get that. Anyway.
Yeah. I was flipping through the book. What's it called?
Misquoting Jesus?
Misquoting Jesus.
Uh-huh.
Or Ehrman. Have you seen that at all?
Well, I've heard a lot about it. I have an article in front of me by Bob Gundry in response to that book. And it's one of the things I have to do when I get everything unpacked from the move I made last month. Sit down and read this book. But only because a lot of people are talking about it, not because, from what I can tell, it's anything fantastic. It's actually all just been there, done that with all of these complaints that he raises about the Scripture. And in particular, his claims of textual corruption. Basically, he's saying that you can't trust the New Testament documents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's where he comes down to. And he points to the kinds of errors that everybody's known about, everybody in the business have known about for a long time. And most of them are virtually inconsequential errors. They don't change anything. They're spelling errors or something. He makes a big deal about John chapter 8, the woman caught in adultery. And, of course, it's no secret that this text probably wasn't in the original. Now, just because it wasn't in the original, that means it's not canon, doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah, a couple that I was looking at was Mark 1, where he heals the leper. And he's saying a couple manuscripts say that Jesus was angry and said, felt compassion, he was angry, and then he healed him.
Okay.
And he says that a lot of church fathers somehow were saying the same thing. But, you know, if we don't have access to what the church fathers said long ago, it's kind of hard to react.
Well, no, we do have access to what the church fathers wrote. I mean, if he's quoting the church fathers, it's because he has a text in front of him. And there's actually volumes upon volumes of that. You can get it's called the church fathers, I think. You got the anti-Nicene fathers. That would be before the Council of Nicaea in 425. And then you have the post-Nicene fathers. And I've got them at home. There's probably 20 volumes of works there.
So supposing he's right and the church fathers did quote it like that. I mean, there's only two manuscripts. I mean,
okay, well, you're suggesting since we have two manuscripts and all the other ones show another thing and the – you're saying that the church fathers are quoting the minority witness. Is that right?
Right. That's what
yeah. Well, I mean, okay, so what? It may be that they have a more accurate translation than the later ones. You know, there is this debate when you look at the Greek manuscripts where there's family of manuscripts. I mean, one whole group of manuscripts looks like itself, and another one, the differences are all look like themselves. You know, you have the critical text and you have the majority text. The critical text usually includes some older manuscripts, the Western text, but there's not as many manuscripts because they're older. The majority text is also a Byzantine text type. And the reason is in the Byzantine Empire, there wasn't as much persecution, so they didn't destroy as many Bibles. And so consequently, we have a lot of these Byzantine texts, but they go back to the 7th or 8th or 9th or 10th centuries, you know, and they're not as old as these other texts. And so there's a debate. Do you go with the majority reference or do you go with the oldest reference? And there's a legitimate discussion. Now, we're not talking about massive differences here, but this is an example of one of them. If you've got an ancient testimony from a church father that gives reference to a text, and it looks like it supports the minority text, I think that might be an argument that the minority witness at that point is more reliable. But, I mean, we're really talking about a refined academic debate about minutiae. And there's no reason that this refined academic debate about minutiae should cast into question the entire corpus of New Testament documents. And I think that's what Bert Ehrman is doing when he cites misquoting Jesus. By the way, Gundry points out that he doesn't spend that much time talking about the misquoting of Jesus. He spends a whole lot of time about other texts and other Old Testament as well. But but not just Jesus. So, I mean, the answer to your question is maybe he did get mad. Maybe that's the accurate rendering. I don't know. I mean, I'm not doing the textual work here, so I can't tell you which one is the better one. But let's just say we don't know the answer to that. What are the ramifications for that, for the integrity of the entire corpus of biblical literature in the New Testament? I don't see how it has any ramifications for that.
Right. Okay. I just wondering how do we which text do we choose? And I know a lot of the modern translations are based on the minorities.
Yes. Well, I think that some of the better translations are. I think the ancient my gut level feeling, frankly, is the ancient more ancient texts are the more accurate ones, and I think that's fair to go that way. And because there's less time, you know, for scribes to change things or to make mistakes. If you got a document that looks like 2nd century or 3rd century, and you got a document that's 7th or 8th or 9th century, I mean, what is most likely to undergone the most change? It just seems like the younger document is going to be less reliable, the older one more reliable. Now, that is not always the case, but you have to look at the individual circumstances. So if you get a book on textual criticism, you could see how they make the decisions that they make. But what Bart Ehrman has done is he's talked about these passages that people have known about for a long time. This has been part of the scholarly debate for you know, decades, centuries even. He's just brought some of it to light and then allowed it to cast more doubt on the process than is really justified given what we've got.
Well, what I don't get is some translations based on the minority text sound the same as in places like this sound the same as translations based on the majority.
Well, that may be because in these particular passages there is no variation between the majority and the majority text, the Byzantine text type, and say a Western or a critical text. Maybe there is no variation. There's a lot of things that just read straight up and they don't vary.
Right, but in this particular, let's say this particular case, nobody translates it like that.
Well, I can't answer the particular question, Neil, about this because I just don't have the textual apparatus in front of me in order to render a judgment, nor am I really skilled to be able to render that judgment on this text. But I just meant to explain a little bit how this process works.
Okay. Hey, thanks for that.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Neil. And listen, we have Melinda just set up a note. Oh, that wasn't Neil. Who was that? I don't know who it was. Neil's coming up. Was that Neil? Yeah, that was Neil. Okay, thank you, Neil. And we got somebody else coming up after the break. But just to mention here, apparently Melinda blogged on this about 10 days ago, and she put a link up for you. So you can go to str.org and go to the blog and search that out. You know, there are two search features on our website. One is for the website general, and then there's a separate search feature for the blog. So if you get into the blog environment and then search there, you'll get the information searched just through blogs. And you might put Bart Ehrman's name, Ehrman, or the title Misquoting Jesus, and you'll get Melinda's reference. But this piece by Bob Gundry, Postmortem, it's titled, Death by Hardening of the Categories, is in Books and Culture, September, October 2006, and it is a response to Ehrman's work on misquoting Jesus. Okay, back in just a moment with your calls on Stand to Reason.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ, but we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800 the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Greg Kokel here, one of the good guys, ladies and gentlemen, equipping you to think every weekend on Stand to Reason. That would be 3 to 5 on Sunday afternoon L.A. time, where you can get the fat out of your thinking and trim down to fight and size. Give the times there for the increasing army of podcast listeners. If you'd like to podcast the show, just go to str.org. In the lower left-hand corner, you'll see a little microphone. Punch that. You'll see a description of how you can have the program sent to you directly, and that's very easy to do nowadays. By the way, if you don't have – I talked to somebody else recently. They don't have – they said, I don't have a like a Macintosh, or I don't have a MP3 player. You can get iTunes, which is the kind of a software vehicle that one of them, the main one really, that functions to allow you to download these things. You know, you can get that for free. It doesn't matter what kind of – it's cross-platform now. So we can still send it to you. And if you don't have a MP3 player, you can listen to it right there on your computer, or you can burn a CD and put it in your car or something like that. So there are a lot of ways to do this. But you have to go there first and subscribe, and we'll do that for you. Hey, I got a chance to go to Wheeling, Illinois. Deborah, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Yeah, hi, Greg. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Do you know my friend Keith Plummer out there in Wheeling?
Plummer.
He's a pastor at a church there, Wheeling. You know, I can't remember the name of that church.
I don't know that name.
Well, he's also a blogger extraordinaire on the God blog side of things. I think Thinking Christian at blogspot.com. That's not it? Okay, we'll get it. Oh, Between Two Worlds? No, we'll get it in a minute. But he's in your neighborhood, so I'll give you his blog address in just a moment. But he's in your neighborhood, and he's a good brother.
Okay.
And a friend of ours for a while. It's called The Christian Mind. The Christian Mind at Blogspot. Yeah. If you just type in The Christian Mind in quotes in Google, you'll find him.
Okay, I'll do that. But I definitely know that name for some reason.
Yeah, well, good. What's on your mind today?
I was wondering, Greg, if you would help me to understand what is meant by ultimate reality in the sense of when people say God is the ultimate reality.
Well, I'm not entirely sure what people mean when they say that. There's been a lot of confusing terms that are tossed around by people. It just makes it harder, like truth and objective truth and absolute truth and ultimate reality and stuff like that. And so sometimes it's not entirely clear what they're talking about. If a thing is true, then it is. Then the claim that is true is describing the world as it actually is in itself. That would be the mind-independent world. It is the world that's out there that is not changed or altered by our mind or our thinking about it. That's why people you can say the world as it is in itself. To say that you can know the world as it is in itself is this view is called realism. You know the real world. And because there's so much abuse of the word truth, like that's your truth, that's his truth, that's their truth, whether it's true or not, some people have opted for additional terms like true truth or absolute truth or ultimate reality to capture the sense of the term that the term truth itself used to capture in the past.
So my suspicion is when people say that God is ultimate reality, that they might be meaning that he is true truth, that he is objective truth, that he that the claims they're making about God are actually so. Now, they can also be meaning that God is the ground of being. That is, all existence comes from God, and nothing would exist or continue to exist if it wasn't the result of God, who is the source of existence itself. And so when you say ultimate reality, they might be meaning that only God is, if they're saying only God is ultimate reality, that could only mean that God is the ground of existence. Because if they say that God is, if they only mean that God is the absolute truth, well, what about statements about me? Don't I exist? Aren't I real? Can't true statements be made about me that are actually so? So it's a little confusing, but it might be any of those things, possibly. Either of those two main things, I guess. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me. Is ultimate reality defined in philosophy?
No, that is not a philosophical term.
It's not.
It's okay. Too vague. That's when I say metaphysical realism, that's the philosophical term that is used to describe the belief that you can, that there is a that there is a world out there that has its own mind independent qualities. Epistemological realism holds that we can know the way the world is in itself, at least in some degree. So ultimate reality is kind of more of a, you know, popular term. And, you know, when anybody says ultimate reality, you just might ask them, what do you mean by that? That's our first Columbo question, by the way.
Okay.
I asked somebody who was talking about absolute truth the other night, what do you mean by absolute truth? And he just gave me a bunch of nonsense. And he kept quoting Jesus. Well, Jesus is absolute truth. I said, yeah, what I want to know is what you mean when you describe Jesus in that way. What does that phrase absolute truth mean when applied to Jesus? In Jesus' term. So we ought to be in a position to be able to explain to other people what we mean by the terms we use. And so when somebody uses the phrase absolute reality, ask them what they have in mind.
Okay.
All righty?
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, check out Keith. Maybe he's just living down the street from you.
He might be, thanks.
I actually went to junior high school in Wheeling.
I know, I had called a couple times and you had said that you had lived here. So if you ever come back to visit friends or family, you're always welcome at our home.
Thank you so much,
your
Deb.
Family.
All righty. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Let's see. It's getting too cold in Chicago right now for me. I'll wait until the springtime. And let's go to Hugh. Hugh, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Love your show.
Thank you.
My question's a two-parter, and I'll say it slowly because it's – I'm trying to – anyway, here we go.
Okay.
Do the use of labels in a dialogue between two people limit understanding? And the second part would be – whether that's true or not, where does this idea come from, that the use of labels in the dialogue?
Oh, yeah, that's an easy one. First of all, it doesn't limit understanding. It increases understanding, all right?
That's my belief, and yet...
Frank Beckwith made a very clever observation once, and, you know, like a lot of things Frank says, you got to think about them twice to see the deeper wisdom. He said there are two groups of people in the world, those who divide up people into two groups and those who don't. Now, the underlying wisdom there is that it cannot – labeling people cannot be avoided. It cannot be avoided. Everybody does it. Oh, you label people. Oh, I get it. So I'm in the group of people that label people, and you're in the group of people that don't label people. So now we have two labels, don't we? The label for those who label people and the label for those who don't label people.
Can you answer critique?
Well, let me just say a little bit more about that.
Right,
it is a human tendency to group like things together, and we do that in order to keep our categories less jumbled in our minds. We see similarities, we group them together. Now, is it possible to label somebody inaccurately? Yes, that's what prejudice is. Prejudice is a prejudging of someone. And so then you see some characteristic of a person and you attach another characteristic that may belong to others of that group but doesn't belong to that individual. So if you say, like, Cretans are always liars, well, maybe you knew some Cretans that were liars, and so you meet another Cretan and then you immediately assume that he's a liar too. But that's a prejudging of a person. You don't know whether he's a liar or not. So that's a label that's an inappropriate label because it might prejudge. But, and I'll tell you the reason I think people complain about labels is because they don't like the label they've been given. This is to answer your second question. They don't like it because it usually is discredits them in some way. So we talk about liberals. Oh, that's a label. Well, because they know we don't like liberals and they don't want to be grouped with people that, you know, are discredited in some way, so they want to distance themselves from it. But you can't avoid it. You know, they don't like value judgments, so they don't want labels. But you can't avoid that either. Everybody makes value judgments. All right, friends, that's all the time for today. Got a whole week ahead of us to be good ambassadors for Christ. Do so wisely, please. And I'll do my best to do the same. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You have a good week, friends. Bye-bye now.